this season finale of The Scorekeepers. I'm your host, Daniel Farrell, and I'll be speaking with jazz and big band composer, Olivia Murphy. Olivia is a British composer focusing on a fusion of through-written and improvisational composition. She is the leader and founder of the Olivia Murphy Jazz Orchestra, a 19-piece big band performing in London and Birmingham. The orchestra won the Peter Whittingham Development Award in 2022, which funded a live recorded EP. Olivia has won numerous awards, including the Jazz Life Alliance Young Composer Award, among many others. I'm excited to hear about her recent performance of her piece, Sister Suite, at the Birmingham Jazz Festival. Welcome to The Scorekeepers. Welcome, Olivia. Awesome to have you on the show. Over the summer, in August, you had a new piece titled Sister Suite. I performed at the Birmingham Symphony Hall as part of their Bee Jazz Fest. Can you tell us a little bit about this piece and how that opportunity came about?
It was a series of two gigs I did. I did with my jazz orchestra, which is, it kind of varies in size sometimes, but for this performance, it was 19 people, including me conducting. And I'd had these 2 dates booked in. It's quite tricky getting big band dates, and it gets trickier and trickier in the UK trying to make that work. It'd been about 18 months since our last performance, and yeah, I wanted to book a couple of special performances in, so I got 2 dates, one at the Vortex Jazz Club in London, and then one at Birmingham Symphony Hall in Birmingham. The Birmingham Symphony Hall was actually where we'd done our debut gig the previous time, and it's such a nice space because it's like we're on the stage, but the Symphony Hall is about 2,000-3,000 seater.
Wow.
And so we weren't filling that space. What they do for jazz performances is a reversed stage, so everyone is on the stage. It's a huge symphony hall stage, and it's one of these beautiful acoustics, but they have the band on the stage facing the choir stalls.
Oh, okay.
And the audience kind of sits towards the back of the stage, looking onwards to the seats, the main auditorium. So they're
right,
sort of in reverse. And it means it's really intimate, but you can still get a couple of hundred people on there. But yeah, anyway, so I had these two dates in Birmingham and Vortex, which is an amazing jazz club in East London. It's one of the best in the UK, and particularly in London. And I wanted to write a new sort of body of work for it. One of the pieces I'd wrote, I'd finished it by end of last year, and I kind of wanted to build on that. And so, yeah, it ended up being something that's called The Sister Suite, and it's a 4-piece suite of music for the big bands. And they're all kind of named after birds. So it's called, the first one's called The Lark She Writes About, then Turtle Dove, then The Gull, and then A Grey coated sandbird, which is actually just from a quote from the book Little Women, and where one of the sisters is sort of just describing each of the other three sisters and herself. The suite's not about Little Women. It's not really like what I just kind of like the quote, and I'm sort of one of three sisters. And I like the idea of sort of everyone having their own pathway. The idea of different women, different people making different choices and being passionate about different things, but becoming over time kind of their own person, and that being the perfect choice for them and perfectly suited. So each piece is sort of quite loose, but each piece is sort of just to do with different facets of personalities of people I know, different facets of sometimes how I feel. The first piece, The Lark She Writes About, is sort of about having hopes and dreams and wanting to see yourself out there and really pushing for it, but also really feeling nostalgic and always having your heart sort of based at home. Turtle Dove is about finding that happiness with someone or something, or within family, or, you know, just finding it with strength within other people, really. The girl is about wanting the struggle, the determination of, it's not so much about the end goal, but more about the journey and riding the storms to improve and learn and develop. And then the Sandbird piece, to the final piece, is all about kind of having those simple things and them being the most important, and the idea that kind of community and having a support network is like the most important thing to keep us going, at least for me. So it's kind of based on that. When I write, I really like having that like sort of story behind when I'm writing. So it kind of started with that. It kind of sort of go off on sort of different directions when I'm in the process of writing, but it really helps having that starting off. And I think the end result did still very much reflect that, which was nice when I was sort of describing it on the gigs.
What was the process like for composing the suite, like sitting down and writing it? Obviously you mentioned like this, these concepts that you had, sort of the birds and what they represent, but how did you approach that musically? You know, how did you, what's your process like for composing?
Well, usually I tend to, usually we'll write primarily from the piano. And well, I actually started on piano, but then I studied jazz saxophone, played a lot of clarinet growing up. So woodwind is more my first study, but piano has always felt sort of relatively comfortable. And that's my go-to, especially when it comes to composing, because it's all there. It helps me visualize. But also as someone that works primarily in more improvised and jazz circles, when I write, it's usually sort of having maybe an idea in my mind, but also improvising with piano, using my voice. I'm not really a singer by any term, but I will use my voice a lot when I'm improvising writing, because it helps add that extra layer, and it really helps guide what's kind of in my head of what I'm hearing, the natural sort of melodic line, where that sort of really to translate that onto the piano and onto the page. So yeah, usually it starts from kind of sketching out ideas. For me, like, I really like a strong melody line or a strong sort of sense of identity that will help form the rest of the piece. I'll tend to improvise around with a few ideas. And if it's something that, usually if it's something that I keep coming back to, something that I can't seem to shake, usually I know that that's something that I want to stick and develop. But I wrote these four pieces over the course of about 9 months. So it is quite nice writing a piece, then coming away from it for a little bit, and then coming back to it, and then reflecting, and then starting something new. And I think it really helps sort of myself give myself that time to sort of reflect on something and rethink a little bit. Sometimes I'll edit it a bit. And yeah, having, for me also, just having the deadline of knowing I have these two dates in the diary, I need this done by then, really helps, because otherwise I just sit sort of fiddling with a piece of music for forever. So it helps just being like, okay, this needs to be done by then. And yeah, I mean, I can't promise it won't be sort of edited slightly if and when it's recorded. But I think that's kind of part of the fun of live performance as well, is that you can. So, but yeah, it was great to have it them performed and just hear it back in such beautiful spaces, because it really makes such a huge difference. But also, yeah, with jazz composition, a big part of it is having solos and improvisation. And I have so many great improvisers in that big band, and many of them are composers themselves, so they really get sort of how important my music is to me, and how their improvisation isn't just their moment to, you know, show off what great lines they've been practicing. It's more about, yeah, I want to hear them and hear their amazing improvisation, but it's also about that contributing to the composition in that moment and building on the story of it all. And the emotion and all that kind of stuff, which I find really special, particularly in a live music setting.
Since you know the performers so well that you're writing for, are you thinking about them when you're composing and like what they're going to bring to the table? You're kind of writing specifically for them?
Yeah, particularly sort of, you know, just when I write a solo in, when I write a bass clarinet feature, or if I want to write a trumpet feature and I have a particular person who I know is going to be playing in the band, it's so helpful because everyone has their own sound and their improvising style, but also just tone and attitude to music. And that's really exciting, having like a friend and like a musical peer being part of that journey and being part of the music. But also it's just great when you have people that you think are incredible musicians just playing something that you've written and going from like horrible like Sibelius sound or whatever to you know, hearing someone who actually can play the trombone, right. You know, is great. So that's really nice. So yeah, it's wonderful.
When you compose in general, but maybe as well for this specific case, but do you sort of write everything out like piano or like record yourself and just kind of, you know, ramp until you get ideas together? Or are you like very conscious of the like orchestration when you're like writing it? Are you like writing like, oh, this will specifically be like a trumpet line? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it does vary, because I've had pieces where I've written it originally for small band or different lineup, or I don't know, solo vibraphone or jazz sextet, and then I've scaled that up to big band. So I thought, oh, that would work well, let's try and make this work and write extra bits and rearrange that. But yeah, when I know, for example, this suite, I knew it was going to be for big band, so write it on piano. And again, with piano, it helps with, it's so visual, I can kind of see, well, top of my right hand, kind of know that that's going to be taken over with more of the higher end, with the higher woodwinds. Maybe sometimes I can think of a trumpet situation going on over here. Lower down here, I know what's going on with the rhythm section or the trombones or whatever. So yeah, there is an element of that. But also I do, like, I'll kind of play around with piano, and I like to sort of write everything on a big manuscript. And I like to pencil in all the ideas, and I just have loads of sort of, I never sort of do a whole chart penciled on, I'm not that old school. I'd love to be able to do that, but I just edit too much and I'd probably just give myself severe RSI if I tried to do all of that. But I do have so much sort of these big sheets of paper that have a full with ideas, and there'll be lots of piano ideas or sort of just scribblings. And to anyone else, I don't think that'll make any sense at all. But to me, it's like, okay, there's this one little idea here, and then here's maybe some chords that I'll do this. And in my head, I'm sort of, there'll be a scribble saying trombones, G7, middle section, drum solo or something. And then it doesn't make any sense in the context of the greater picture, but I'll kind of know, okay, I'm talking about this bit here. Or it will just say something like fluttery ideas from woodwind or something silly like that. But it'll just help me. It's kind of like that kind of brain throwing up onto the page a little bit and trying to like write something down, because the process of like getting, the part I dislike the most is probably the sitting on my laptop writing it all up on Sibelius, which is what I use, but because it's I just find it all a bit sort of boring. But I mean, it's cool when you're in the, when I'm on a bit of a roll with it, I can. But I think just from the fun getting the ideas down to the actually sitting and first getting it on the page on the computer sometimes takes me a bit of a like a kick to do that,
right?
Because it's just sort of, I mean, it's like transcribing something up, it's not always the most thrilling thing. But yeah, but then I can, usually it's sort of a case of I already know what's happening and the different things I've sort of thought it in my mind, or I just start thinking about it when I'm moving it over. I sort of think, oh, I need something to play that, I'll double that here or whatever. So it's sort of a mixture of everything, really. It does vary on the piece, it varies what I'm writing for or what feels right. It might change in the moment as well.
I also wanted to touch on, at the same jazz festival, that this was performed, that Sister Sweet was performed. You also had some of your pieces from your EP Somewhere Not So Far Away performed. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about how that process, writing those charts, was maybe different than the Sister Sweet? Maybe it was the same?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's similarities and differences, mostly because some of the pieces in that, the live EP that's online, I wrote sort of quite a lot longer ago. So in terms of experience and attitude coming to writing for big bands, there's more learning in between those spaces, just more time. I wrote a lot of that. Some of it I wrote before all of COVID. Some of it during.
It really is like a good pre and post. Everybody's pre-2020, post-2020.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's like looking back on it, like really happy with all that recording, and then you think, oh, I've, you know, definitely prefer more stuff I write more recently now. But at the same time, one of the pieces in that EP, Clockwork and Water, is was one of the first big band pieces I ever wrote for. And actually, but that was one of the ones that was originally for Sextet. And it was sort of a series of, like, that in itself was sort of a different suite for my Sextet, sort of a 20-minute thing that was based on just little small ideas. And it was very improvised, like freely improvised within. I was playing soprano saxophone plus voice, trombone and rhythm section. So that came from that. And then a couple years later, maybe it was sort of 2018 or 19, I wanted, or maybe 2019, I wanted to scale it up. And I'm still really proud of that. That's still one of my favorite ones, because I think it's, although I've edited it a lot since then, I've again come back to it quite a bit and maybe changed some of the voicings that I wasn't as happy with. But the kind of essence and the emotion of what I was trying to convey, I think is still really strong and compositionally. I think it's, I'm just really happy with it. It was kind of about, I wrote it about sort of like grief and the idea of moving on and sort of feeling at sort of a turning point maybe. And I think it captures how I listened to it. And I really remember how strongly how I feel I was feeling at that time, which is nice. And also that piece particularly is what the start of me exploring more with band group free improvisation. So lots of people improvising at once, which I've done more in this Sister Sweet. There are lots of moments of different ways of utilizing that, which I find really interesting. So rather than just having an individual soloist, having a few people improvising at once, or the whole band, or in the most recent gigs I was in conduction, so conducting the improvisation, which maybe to some people might feel like counterintuitive or kind of against what improvisation should be. But it's really interesting because it's like directing the motion of where the improvisation is going as a conductor. And when you have a big band that's, you know, really got their eyes up and are really talented at what they do, they're really attentive and they want the best for the music, it makes it for a really special part of the music, because that can never be recreated, because
right.
It was a one-time thing and that improvisation won't ever happen again, you know. So it makes it really special. So I think particularly with that one, you know, it's always something that I feel really proud of. But I think the process of writing all those pieces were kind of the same, kind of different. I don't know, it's sort of like the same sort of writing at the piano, scaling it up, but I guess it's just experience and life experience. What you bring to the composition changes as well, and what you know, tastes as well. Maybe it's the main thing.
I was curious about, as we touched on with the improv aspect of it, like how specific do you get with the improv? What are you kind of thinking when you're, you know, when I say writing the piece, I mean kind of structuring where you want improv to go. Is it the same in all your pieces? I mean, you just mentioned having the whole band sort of improvising at once. I mean, you know, what are you thinking and how do you kind of plan for all of that?
I mean, so if I'm going to write a solo, which often I do in most of my compositions, it will be because it compositionally adds to the structure of the piece. And I don't really, I mean, one of my biggest musical heroes is Duke Ellington. And, you know, I love Count Basie. And music of that time is very much, here's the head or the kind of melody in scaled for the big band. Then it might be a solo section. Then it might be, have like a shout chorus. And then maybe another solo, but maybe then the head out. And it's quite a, you know, like a go-to structural thing of big band music of the time. But I don't know, for me now, like looking at more modern big band composers who really utilize improvisation as part of the composition, it's not just, here's your time for a blow, like have fun and then see you in, you know, 2 minutes or something. You know, it's not just, you know, you've got 20 minutes at the end of the set, so you're just going to do a blues and everyone gets a blow. That's not really what, I mean, that's great. And I've definitely been the horn player in that band and that's very fun. But it's, you know, for it, as in terms of a, you know, composition being the really serious attitude towards it, like you want to be part of the structure and you want it to be that it really impacts the music. I look up to someone like Maria Schneider a lot, who, you know, the solos take one part of the writing to another part through the way of the solo. That's what I'd like my writing to do, where it's, and you know, when you look at someone like Basie or Ellington, that the solos are doing the same thing as well, because it is still taking it from this to this. It's just, you know, it's finding modern pathways to do that. I think now is, you know, now we're in today, we can find new ways of doing that. And so, I mean, with solos, it might be something that's, I say, particularly in the freer moments where there's maybe not just strict chord symbols, I might, and probably usually will, give some sort of descriptor or like adjective, or I don't know, in the Clockwork and Horse piece, it's sort of saying flowing like the tide coming in, or, you know, raucous or angry, just small things. And it's still up to the improviser to take what they want from that. But I think it's important to still sort of say the direction. So being clear where that solo is starting in the music, in the context of the whole piece, and where it's going to end up is really important. Because otherwise you just...
Right.
It's just a solo for the sake of solo. And then if you're doing that, you may as well just be on a small band. I'm not, you know, it's hard work getting, you know, organizing 20 people in a room together. And if it's just about people doing a solo and then walking off the stage, it's not, we don't need a big band for that. So we can, I don't know, we can think of it sort of really try and be as clever in terms of the structure and make it interesting and fresh. And there's lots of opportunities there to hear people. And also what's great is finding, I don't have loads of like straight ahead bebop jazz musicians in my band. I mean, I have loads of people who are capable of doing that and sound amazing doing it. But I have loads of people who are great musicians and improvisers in different ways. So some people that are maybe from a really sort of more free improvising background who really excel at that. Some people who sound great on like a really bluesy saxophone sort of groove. Some people who really contemporary or more modern sounding, I don't know. And it's finding different spaces that suit that player. So it's going back again to choosing the right people for the band and thinking, you know what, I'm not going to give like a really straight ahead blow to someone that doesn't play like that. It's finding the right spaces for the right people. And so it all kind of adds up like that. Yeah, so I think that's usually how I'm thinking of solos, is it's the way for something fresh and interesting to contribute to the composition and have these players that I admire so much be part of it, which is really special.
Speaking of the band, the Olivia Murphy Jazz Orchestra, which you course founded, can you just tell us about like the ensemble and what it means to you, and you know, who they are to you?
Well, I think when we first did it, there was 21 More recently, it's 19, just because, like, to be frank, money is, it's hard paying people. but, you know, like, the more people, the merrier, really. And it's really hard, I think, anywhere. But in the UK, it's quite hard getting together a big band. And there aren't regular big band nights, not even here in London. There'll be, you know, you'll be able to go and see a big band of varying levels, usually at least a couple times a week somewhere. But, you know, it's not, we don't have the history here of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, when we're doing this music, whether it's small band or big band, it's usually you either get external funding, which is difficult to get, or it's a self-funded or, you know, self-organized sort of thing. And I mean, it makes, you really have to want to do it in the first place. And, you know, it's hard booking the gigs and making it work, but I think the payoff is huge. And I just have always really, I mean, I studied first like jazz saxophone, and I really liked playing and I really liked studying, but I think I always felt like writing and sort of creating the music felt, I just had so much less of a like anxiety about being the composer versus how I felt when I was studying saxophone, and still do sometimes when it comes to playing, that, like, for me, the writing thing, I feel so much more at home in. And it's funny as well, because, you know, the standing doing a gig on saxophone would really always worry me, whatever the situation usually. Whereas standing in front of a big band conducting it with my music, I get a little bit nervous before the gig, but it's nowhere near the level of anxiety. So, and I think, like, I just really love doing it. So it's great. We haven't done, like, loads and loads of gigs, but I hope there's more to come, and recordings and stuff. But every time we do it, it's really special. And I think a big part of that is because of the openness and supportive nature of the people in the band, who I think really resemble a lot of the players from the Birmingham and London scenes. It's really great standing in front of the band conducting my music, but I think it makes it all the more special for having such, like, supportive people in the band who are really representative of the openness and supportiveness of the London and Birmingham jazz scenes, which, you know, it's sometimes intimidating coming into a city and sort of trying to get your music out there. But so many of the people that play in the band, but also, you know, people that I've met, have been so open and supportive of new music, which is really positive, because there isn't, you know, the new music scene is something that people are doing because they love doing it, rather than it being, you know, especially in jazz, you know, it's not the go-to money making mm-hmm. scheme. So it's really nice that that's the support. Also, I studied in Birmingham. I just moved to London without studying. So it was really nice just, you know, sending a few people a message and sort of saying, hey, like, this is my music. I really love your playing. Would you be up for coming and doing, like, a playthrough of a few of these charts, or doing a tune workshop? And, you know, just really nice people sort of saying, yeah, great, really like this stuff, sounds great, and really up for it. And just, I think that's really a positive musical environment and a creative atmosphere. And also, I sort of said to myself, look, I'm running a big band, going to be booking, organising 20 people at times. I only want to book and work with nice people. So that was kind of a choice I made right at the start. And it was sort of, I could message, you know, some of the older, like, most killing people I've ever met, but, you know, if some of them have a bit of a bad rep about them, it's like, you know what, I'm going to book people that, you know, aren't sort of either in my sort of
You want to work similar with background.
Yeah, exactly. Friends and sort of people that are like-minded and positive. And because I just think there's too many great players where I am in London, in the UK, for, you know, to sort of just worry yourself about yourself a bad impression about your own music. No one needs that. So that was really helpful from the start, and definitely like advice I'd give people younger than me, just sort of say, like, you know, book people you trust and people who are going to respect your music. Friends obviously is great, but also it doesn't need to be, you know, all band of friends, but it's just people that you can form that friendship with them during the project. But just don't waste your time on people that aren't going to respect you.
I wanted to close out with how you found that love for jazz and for big band. I mean, England is not the first place you'd think of for jazz and big band music. So how did you kind of discover it and fall in love with that whole scene?
How do I start? So maybe I started with like usual sort of piano lessons growing up, doing what we have, which is called the ABRSM syllabus. So it's like the kind of more classical grades that you do. Most people will go through that syllabus. I was introduced to clarinet teaching when I was in primary school, had sort of in-school music lessons. And then when I was about 14 or 15, as part of doing music, as part of my, I don't know what the equivalent is in America, but like GCSE, I was about year 11, so about 15, 16. I don't know what year equivalent that is, but I got a saxophone lesson, and I'd been wanting to like try a saxophone because I just thought it was so cool, and I'd always choose to do the jazzier piece in these classical grades. I mean, they're always like relatively, they're probably, really looking back on them, aren't the most true to what jazz is, but at the time, like however old I was then, like thinking, oh, this is really cool, this sort of weird piano piece with slight swing feel. I think starting on saxophone, and then sort of 15 16, I was really able to dig in a little bit, and I just really liked it, and I thought it was really cool. And there was one teacher who taught jazz saxophone in probably all of Peterborough where I grew up, and so I was able to have some lessons with him. He taught my sixth form, the sort of when I was like 16 to 18, and he managed to give me like just the right amount of stuff to get into music college, just about scraped through, because I really didn't have very much and other training at all, and so it's a big learning curve. But you know, I got through, and I think I had a lot to learn when I was at music college, and it was very much an uphill battle. But I think finding music, I think I'd definitely heard a fair bit of jazz, and I'd like playing in big bands, which, like, more than anything else, my sight reading was always really strong above other things. And so I always used to play in lots of big bands throughout college and a couple of years beforehand. And I think I just took in a lot of that music through playing it and really enjoyed it. And then since, just finding so many composers, particularly from the New York scene, to be honest, that's really inspiring, just seeing how people are sort of there just doing it all the time. It's amazing. But also just the British jazz scene is really inspiring as well, when you look at people like Norma Winston, Nicky Isles, the kind of adoptive Brit Kenny Wheeler was hugely inspiring to me, someone like Django Bates. So it's like there's lots of people that are creating that kind of music, and you look around, you think, okay, I see myself here. You just trying to find the right place in it and pushing through. So,
well, it has been amazing speaking with you, Olivia, and we'll have links for your EP, you know, as soon as there are some recordings of Sister Sweet publicly available. Of course, go listen to them. But yes, yeah, fantastic speaking with you and hearing about the English jazz scene, and yeah, it's been great.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was wonderful hearing from Olivia about her musical journey and her recent performance of Sister Sweet. Please check out her site and social media for more information on upcoming performances. Thanks for listening to The Scorekeepers. The Scorekeepers is produced by Daniel Farrell Music and Sound, with graphic and visual design by Patrick Farrell. Scorekeepers is proudly hosted and recorded using Zencastr. Thanks for listening to this season of The Scorekeepers. If you enjoyed what we do, subscribe and leave a rating. Without your support, this show would not be possible. Thanks again.